A miracle of modern podcasting, Jim Briggs.
What?
What? Hard hitting, cutting edge, made up. It's time for the lightest form of flogging's fake news break with Skip Bohockey. Good morning or evening or whenever you choose to listen to this dumb show. I'm Skip Bohockey. In Southern Baptist news, SBC officials announced today from Louisville a change in casserole standards for local church potlucks. The proposed changes include a reduced threshold for saturated fats and caloric levels per serving, along with mandatory gluten-free options in every potluck. Regarding the new standard, spokeswoman Ethel Woonsocket was quoted as saying, "We are approaching a new time in SBC culture where it is imperative that we offer alternatives to attract millennials and green-conscious churchgoers. It's also high time we ignore the dwindling faction of old people and their incessant need for holding on to old traditions." Reaction to the new standards has been fierce from many of the rural congregations. The pastor for 13th Baptist Church in Broken Whistle, Alabama, Cletus Unger III, was quoted as saying, "They can pry my high-calorie green bean casserole from my swollen, dead hands if they feel so entitled. In fact, I will be ordering our congregants to triple the salt content in our casseroles just to spite everyone. I will never back down. I will never surrender." Cletus then tore off his shirt and beat a reporter nearly to death. In Presbyterian news, an emerging power struggle in the PCA is threatening to tear the denomination apart. The PCA has cited increasing concerns that a rogue faction of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America is attempting a hostile takeover by infiltrating their music teams and imposing an obscure doctrine known as exclusive psalmody by force. An anonymous threat was found posted on the bulletin board at Crossway Presbyterian Church in Orlando, Florida, that stated, and I quote, "If you do not sing the Psalms exclusively, but rather insist on your guitar solos and skinny-jeaned worship leaders singing Hillsong songs, we will randomly cut microphone cords, hack into sound systems, and mess with the sound mix, kidnap your drummers, and post social security numbers of your piano players. If our demands are not met, our efforts will only escalate." Unquote. PCA leaders have been begging for help to combat this invasion, but so far their situation has only gotten worse. A GoFundMe page has been created to raise funds in their efforts to push back that has so far raised $3.2 million to pay for the damaged equipment thanks to a Gospel Coalition article written in support of the resistance. Okay, and now it's time for a special guest correspondent, Tom Brokaw. I don't know why we have to give this guy time. He can't even pronounce the letter L. Shh, Skip, we're not supposed to mention that on air per Tom's contract. We talked about this a couple of times. You think the audience won't notice? Are you kidding me with this? I've worked my way up in this business only to be replaced. Wow, this is not fair.
It's just one segment. Don't worry. It's a human interest story that doesn't mean anything. Skip, I think you need to bring it down a notch. Can we not do this on air? The news segment is live, by the way.
I just think you're making a big mistake.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, thank you, Jim and David, for giving me this time on your show. I am very honored. Skip, thank you as well for graciously accommodating me.
Yeah, great.
In local news, a Spokane pet named Tubby scored a touchdown in the recent Puppy Bowl. A popular dog event for pet lover broadcasted on Super Bowl. Oh, man.
Does this sound good to any of you? Skip, shut up. Let him get through this.
We are on the air, guys.
Tubby's owner, Leslie Lowe.
I just can't say it right. Was it an Hispanic puppy, Tom?
No, that's uncalled for, Skip. And I expect you to conduct yourself professionally.
What's that, Tom? What are you trying to say? Talk much?
One more word, and I will bring this to the next level.
Sounds like a plan, Lips. Come at me.
Oh, for Pete's sake, what is with you people? This is your fault, Jim.
My fault? What did I do?
Our news guy just assaulted Tom Brokaw live on air, and we're probably going to get sued.
Oh, let's just start the show.
I'm sure it can't get any worse.
You want to take that bet?
The podcast you are about to hear contains the histrionic and problematic conversations of a stodgy Presbyterian and a casserole-loving Baptist. Their interactions are volatile at times and unpleasant most of the time. In many nations, this is considered a mild form of torture. We strongly advise you to stop this nonsense and go do something useful with your life. Otherwise, if you insist on listening to this mess, welcome to the lightest form of flogging.
As the deep voice man said, welcome to the lightest form of flogging podcast.
Hi.
I'm your co-host, David McCookie, and sitting across the room from me at a contractually renegotiated 29 and a half feet is my co-host, Jim Briggs, who seems to be inching closer to me.
Little bit by little bit. Hey, folks, episode 30, huh? This is a milestone. I feel like we've made it.
It's also my second intro in a row, not just quoting The Office. I'm pretty proud.
That's all I do.
I know. It's not all you used to do. You used to have all of them. And then I decided I'm not going to be original anymore. And then you followed suit. Okay. And now I'm trying to trying to make intros great again, Jim.
And I know you are the man to do that. There's just too much goodness in obscure Dwight quotes that true. Just seemed to work really well in my,
they really do.
In my,
well, they work better for me because your name is Jim.
Yeah. The rivalry between Dwight and Jim can work well in our show, from time to time. Hey, let's get right into it.
You want to dive in?
We're going to dive into our follow-up. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have you go first. I don't know what you're going to say about this next follow-up point. I'm curious and I'm nervous at the same time. The edit button, my hand is hovering over the edit button as we speak, jittery and ready to pounce. So go ahead. Go.
Oh, we discussed Data's relations. You brought up an episode. I think it's like the second episode in season one.
Season one? That's all the way back in season one.
I'm pretty sure. Maybe it's not the second episode, but it's really early. I mean, Tasha dies in like the first season or two. But there's also Star Trek First Contact. Data and the Borg Queen, ..
Tread carefully.
Dim the lights. The end. And I just wanted to say, because you brought this up, you're like, oh, something happened with Data.
I wasn't inviting more thought.
There might be other situations that come up in future. This may be a like 5-episode string of,
I like how vague we're being
regaling
right
the audience about Data's history.
We are being so non-specific that it's almost not worth mentioning to the audience, but somehow it is.
Let's just say that Data has a relationship with someone
other than
Tasha Yar and then the Borg Queen in Star Trek First Contact, which is a movie, it's still part of canon, I think.
Yeah, of course.
Unlike the new movies, which are part of a new canon.
Right. Where do we go from here?
I
have the next point of follow-up.
That's yours, yeah.
Yes.
We're 50-50 this week.
Boom. So last week, we were talking about Muzak. I mentioned the band Jars of Clay, and I was trying to make a point that Jars of Clay is not a Christian band, but in contrast, and I kind of stumbled over my words, I was trying to articulate that there were a musical group that happened to be Christians, comprising a musical group, but they were not a Christian band, and I couldn't figure out the phrase, and a Slack listener chimed in and said, hey Jim, what you were trying to say was, Jars of Clay is not a Christian band, but a band of Christians, clarity was brought. I felt better, and I thought I'd mention it on the show. That's what I was trying to say.
Nice.
And there are a lot of bands like that, and we were thinking that was a good thing. 15 years ago, I thought that was a scary thing.
There should be more.
Yeah, there should be more.
More.
And there's probably going to be a lot more as time goes on. Okay, that's a follow-up.
I listened to their album, the first album.
Like recently?
Flood. Yeah, like this week.
Oh, what do you think?
Basically inspired by this episode. They have some really bad theology. There are certain lines where I'm just like, if I try to be as charitable as I possibly can, that's Pelagian. Like, not even Arminian. That's just Pelagian.
Well, no one's accusing Jars of Clay of being a group of high-minded Calvinists, for sure.
For sure.
But like when you said that, I was about to say excitedly, oh, David, what'd you think about the music? You hit me with something that I should know. You were going to say that. But they're one of my favorite groups. I listened to that album many, many times over, and I don't really remember too much about what they said. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just kind of the music, you know? I should be paying more attention to the, theologically speaking, what they're saying, but I didn't at the time,
right.
And I haven't listened to that album in forever.
Well, now you can. Now you can come back and be like, okay, yeah, you were right.
Okay, all right. Well, perhaps we will find provision for that band yet in the future for our listeners. Good album. I like the album. Weird on the theology. Hey, you do what you want with it, folks. Just like everything we say, you do what you want with it. We'll keep going. We'll figure it out somewhere in the future.
No, audience, Jim has just prompted an impromptu excursus in follow-up by means of his face.
Oh, why did I do that? By means of my... You were gazing into my eyes and
I was thinking about this actually on Sunday when I saw you.
Okay.
Is your plan... Like, I'm trying to figure out... audience, Jim has shorn his face, save his goatee.
Oh, we're talking about my facial hair. Okay.
He has shaved his face except for his goatee.
Okay.
And now he's not shaving again. And so what he has is like a 7 p.m. shadow and a goatee, like a full, like,
what did you want me to do?
Inch long goatee.
So this is the first time I've done this when I have made a facial hair.
No, I'm not critiquing error. You. Okay. I'm not critiquing you.
See, I was getting ready for
you. That's not what I thought that's what you're doing. I want to understand what your plan is because it's going to look really funny at some point.
It's already looking funny, but it looks less funny than it did.
You didn't have any. Right. I'm thinking what you need to do is like in another few days when you feel like your face is just dark with hair.
Yeah.
Just trim everything to that length and let it regrow.
See, I can't do that because I don't have a chin. And when I
have less of a chin than you, sir.
You do not. I have the least amount of chin that there has ever been done was in all of the people world.
Well said.
When I shave my face, mm-hmm, people get scared. Like my wife doesn't talk to me.
Okay. But that's what I'm saying is like, wait for it to get a little bit longer.
Why? This looks fine. I
think it's going to look funny at some point.
It's a little meth head. It's a little meth dealer. I know, but it's
just a little meth dealer.
Another week and it'll look great.
Okay. Your face.
Okay. And we'll reevaluate next week and we'll see how I do.
Office reference.
Okay, good. So now that my beard is taken care of, where to go from here? Hey,
should we start the main topic?
No, what? We shouldn't. We should do what I want to do, not what you want to do. So folks, hey, if you want to be on the show,
I want to do what you want to do.
I know you do.
Paradox.
And you will. Wait, huh? Oh, anyways. So hey folks, if you want to be on the show, you can call the show. Just dial 1-707-99-TULIP. Or 1-707-998-8547, and you can leave us a voicemail. Yes, you can.
And if you're feeling bold, daring, and dangerous, you can leave off the one.
Who knows where...
Unless you're in Canada.
Who knows where AT&T will send you?
basically to our voicemail inbox.
Probably, which is the most mysterious place of all. And you can leave us a voicemail. Questions, comments, concerns, whatever you want. Personal feelings, hopes, dreams, aspirations. So call us, won't you? We are ready to believe you. So, folks, this is a part of the show where I asked David to tell you, our fine listeners, how to get on our Slack.
It's actually on the script.
But normally we don't like too much define what that is. So right. I just wanted to take a little bit of time and say, when we mention Slack, which is linked in our show notes that you guys can go to, it's an online meeting place for listeners of the show. It is also a silly place, right, David?
Yes, let us not go there.
A little silly. But if you would like to join us in our frivolity, David is going to tell you, our listeners, how to join us on our Slack online meeting place for listeners of the Learning from the Flying Podcast. Go ahead, David.
If you would like to join us in our chat room, IRC AIM chat room thingy called Slack, you can go to slack.techreformation.com. You'll need to provide your email address and password. Don't worry, we will not spam you. Once you provide that, you can find the hashtag flogging channel. Slack is something you can either use in your web browser or use in a downloadable app on basically all platforms. So give it a shot. Talk to Jim. Jim needs friends.
Yeah, I'm not on Facebook, so I'm horribly alone in my life. And I just hang out on our Slack on someone else's podcast and wait for people to come talk to me.
That's
talk to me, won't you? Could you digitally hold me? Sorry. Come digitally hold Jim on our Slack.
That makes me really uncomfortable.
Me too. It's uncomfortable that I'm not uncomfortable with that. So, hey, we've been breezing along in our housekeeping. We're going to get right into our topic.
Whirling through.
Yes, this is great. So what are we going to talk about today, David?
Jim, today I have been wanting to do this for some time and it was my turn to pick a topic.
And you laid it on me.
I thought this is a good time, as good a time as any anyway, to talk about what you have referred to in the past as your EFS moment. Now, EFS moment is pretty specific.
EFS is a word which here refers to eternal functional subordination, or the doctrine that the Son eternally submits to the Father.
It's a flogging phrase at this point in time.
Yeah. So EFS moment is not something that you're going to hear listening to Tim Keller, D.A. Carson, and
for good reason.
John Piper at a table for the Gospel Coalition and talk about eschatology.
Now, come on, David. Calm yourself. Let's not get too down on them today.
So, I wasn't down on them. I'm just saying they're not going to say the phrase EFS moment. Yeah. That's probably a good thing.
So EFS moment at this point has been your EFS moment, actual EFS.
Right. Yeah. And where, yeah, so
we have to help with the confusion. Oh,
so I have to explain my EFS moment.
I think we just briefly just, right. Yeah, because we just usually pile on confusion for our listeners. I want to try and take those piles, make the piles lighter.
So I'm not going
to
explain the theology behind what the moment was, because we've done that on other episodes. Yeah. But what I will say is there was a moment when I believed something taught by a number of popular Bible teachers, particularly those who would be considered New Calvinists, not by me, but by others, because I don't use the phrase New Calvinist anymore.
And this is, and I hate to interrupt you here, but like other teachers that are not New Calvinists would probably fall into this error too, right? Would you think that
in modernity? Yeah. A lot of evangelicals, a lot of basically non-confessional guys, people who, when they're thinking to sit down and write about the Trinity, don't think I'm going to start with the catechisms or I'm going to start with the Nicene Creed.
But most of the people in your sphere, I guess we should just say at the time, Calvinism. Okay. Yeah.
And even outside, I mean, the issue was that I did not believe something that the Nicene Creed says about who the Son is in relation to the Father.
Weird, right? That should be like a given, right? That should like be the first thing a Christian learns.
Right. Like let's believe what the Nicene Creed says. And maybe the Apostles' Creed too.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I didn't know that I didn't. It's not like I intentionally.
Not on purpose, right? You didn't look at a line in the Nicene Creed and say, I don't like that.
And it was because of, I mean, all I had,
you got
all the teaching that I had on the topic of the Trinity was from these teachers who, and I'll mention Grudem and Ware were two big ones for me, who either denied it explicitly or implicitly, or just did not talk about it.
So there was a period a couple years ago where people noticed, I'll say quietly noticed, that they were, claiming some things about the doctrine of God or the Trinity, I should say the Trinity, that were a little suspect, and it kind of blew up all of a sudden, didn't it?
Well, sort of all of a sudden. It was 10 years in the making in academia, it was a blog that finally like blew it up into the public field.
What one was that? That was Mortification of Sin,
which is that's a fun podcast to listen to.
Yeah, I like that podcast. They're funny. Much better than ours.
We're a little bit modeled after them.
Yeah, a little bit.
In the sense that I listened to them and
taking some inspiration.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have
that. Like how you said, taking some inspiration, and I said, stole some things.
Okay. That's uni. Anyway, so this blew up, became a big controversy. And so
something that had happened to me was I had been reading through, I had read through John Calvin's Institutes, and John Calvin believes and teaches what is said about the Trinity in the Nicene Creed. And I had read through Francis Turretin's Institutes of Eclectic Theology.
So not a New Calvinist thing to do, to read through the Institutes.
either of the Institutes. Yeah.
And much less
title,
much less Turretin too.
Right. And so I had read through these sections and I still didn't believe what the Nicene Creed said about the Trinity. And when all of this came out, I went back to Turretin and
you resisted.
Well, no, I just didn't understand. I had no idea that what I believed wasn't the same thing as what I was reading. And I skimmed through, this isn't about me, Jim, this is about you, but I skimmed through those sections thinking I already know this. I read it in Grudem. Yeah. Like this is just basic Trinity stuff.
Yeah. You were taking a lot of things for granted.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so when that whole thing occurred, I had this spotlight shone on my ignorance.
Okay. Yeah.
That not everybody else could see. Like nobody else knew, nobody else cared.
You became aware of it.
But I became like keenly aware that like, I think there's a recording in one of the past episodes of me saying, "You don't know the Trinity," and it's all echoey. Like that was what happened. The spotlight came on and I was like, like the Nicene Creed. Like here I am thinking, oh, I should teach people Calvinism and covenant theology, like on my blog and stuff. And I don't believe what the Nicene Creed says about the Trinity.
Tripped over a very simple, not simple concept, but tripped over something that you should have known, right?
Yes.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
I should know this.
Like not
I
just as a Reformed person, but as a Christian.
Yeah.
Like as an Orthodox non-heretic Christian, I should believe these things.
And you wondered like, how is this possible? How did this happen?
Exactly.
How did this happen?
And so that caused me to put the brakes on a lot of my writing efforts, on a lot of my, I don't often get asked to teach at our church, but, since that point, if I were to be asked, my response would be probably not.
Well, actually, I looked into this and the reason why they don't ask you is because the last time you did it, you forgot to wear pants.
What is it with you? This is the second episode in a row.
It's my favorite joke.
You're talking about me not wearing pants.
It is my favorite joke and I try and shoehorn it in whenever I can. That's why they didn't ask you back and you should work on that next time.
No, I wore the slacks, and if listeners would like to join us on the slacks.
Don't join David's slacks. Join our slack. So this caused a sort of reluctance.
Yeah, a reluctance to teach, a desire to shut up, a desire to go back to the basics, to start studying the Westminster Shorter Catechism, which is a children's catechism.
all right.
And
so it was a game
that
changer.
That was my EFS moment. That's the summary of it. Was I realized I didn't understand some really basic doctrine, even though I thought I was kind of a, to use your words, theological cheese whiz kid.
Cheese whiz kid. That's right.
No, that's I got your Wisconsin in there by accident.
Oh, thank you.
And it just resulted in a lot of changes for me. So I want to talk about what you have coined, your EFS moment.
Yes.
Which pertains not to the Trinity per se, but to the hypostatic union.
Yeah. I had also an EFS moment. I should say that, my EFS moment was also inspired by EFS. I mean, I too had similar thoughts.
So this was around the same time.
Yeah, it was around the same time because it kind of inspired me to think about what else am I getting wrong? Mm-hmm. What else am I not quite sure on? What else am I shaky on that might cause problems in the future? Like if I have this blind spot, where are my other blind spots? So EFS for me kind of inspired this. So that's why I called it my EFS moment, even though I also had an EFS moment. I've had like many EFS moments, but like the one that has meant the most to me, the one that has produced the most change was in regards to the hypostatic union. So this was my big one. I have long wondered about how that worked.
How the hypostatic union works.
How does that work? I mean, it is by nature a little bit tricky. So the hypostatic union was long a curiosity of mine, but I fell into this strange belief that I got it, and that it was boring to me for a time, and this crept into other things too, like the Trinity. It was like not a big deal to me,
right.
Trinity. Okay, I got this. I got that. You know, it's not too complicated. You know, I can comprehend the Trinity. This is the 22-year-old reform moron Jim that and a whole lot of other theological concepts that just for this mindset that I fell into. I wasn't like too impressed with a lot of stuff. I just thought that I got it. I got this handled. I could read all these complicated books. I think I thought of myself as just this theological whiz kid. And then all of a sudden, God showed me that I was actually a moron, an idiot. And he did it through this hypostatic union because I discovered that I was getting tripped up by it.
Now,
quite a bit.
You wanted, when you say you thought you understood it and you thought you comprehended it, you would have at the same time, I'm assuming here, this is a question, you would have at the same time said, of course, nobody can fully understand the Trinity. Like God is unintelligent. Yeah. Like he's not fully knowable, but I can know the things the Bible says about him.
Yeah. Like I can fully grasp the things that are graspable about the Trinity and it's no big deal.
Right.
In other words, I wasn't humbled by these things. Mm-hmm. And I think I realized that one day and it kind of freaked me out. I thought there's something wrong. Like none of these theological concepts have me in awe. And it has nothing to do with the theological concepts. I think there's something wrong with me. Because that's arrogance on a level that few can really manage to achieve.
Oh, most do.
Yeah, I guess I'm not really. Yeah, I mean, you're right. You're right. A lot. We have a great capacity to achieve that level of arrogance. But let's just say I was in it, and there was something wrong with that. And I think the hypostatic union became like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look into this, and I think I'm going to try and figure this out. And I think I want to find the heart of the hypostatic union and see if I can get this sorted out in my mind, because I think I'm doing this wrong. So around the same time, I was a part of a book club that was about to read Stephen Wellam's book, God, the Son Incarnate, The Doctrine of Christ. Mm-hmm. Pretty big book. I figured, man, I think I'm going to get on the right path if I read through this book and discuss it with other guys and see what I'm getting wrong here, because I really, 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 really want to get this. And I want to get it right, because I think I'm getting it really, really, really wrong. And I'll explain why I think I got, how I got wrong a little bit later. But we went through this book, and it was a pretty comprehensive book. It doesn't just talk about the hypostatic union, but the section on the hypostatic union, to me, changed a whole lot of things. I kind of had my EFS moment when I read that chapter, and everything changed for me. And it was weird. I mean, of all the doctrines that could do this, I read a chapter in a book about the hypostatic union, and I was different after I read it. So I figured something happened, and that must have been my EFS moment, where I realized how stupid I was, how arrogant I was. I was humbled by reading it, and I'm different now. So that has to be a big thing. And you and I, we talk about not theology, and I'm going to try and stay away from the theological weeds today. We like to talk about how we evolved, what's different, how we changed. And that's why this is a good topic for today. This is how I changed after learning more about this. So, yeah.
That being said, I think we should step on a theological weed. And you should just explain, I guess. I mean, you said that you got it wrong.
Yeah.
So what was the thing about, I mean, you obviously believed God, that Jesus was God and that Jesus was man.
Yeah. Like hypostatic union, the reformed definition of it. If I read that, I go, yeah, okay, I'm there. I just, you know, if someone were to put a gun to my head, I mean, explain this. I couldn't, I had no idea what I was doing, because to anticipate your question, you're asking, how did I get it wrong?
You're not anticipating it. I asked that.
Okay. I couldn't remember.
you're post-anticipating it.
Well, I went in my Wayback Machine and didn't know where I was. So yeah, how did I get it wrong? How will we ever get Jim back? Here's how I got it wrong. I remembered back to a theology class back at Union, the school that I went to. The class was about doctrine of Christ. And we talked about the work of Christ, person of Christ, all these fun things. And we talked about kenotic theology, or kenosis, theology of kenosis.
I kind of know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I kind of know what you're talking about. Just to a brief definition of those who don't know what that means. It's the theology that tries to explain the passage in Philippians 2 that talks about Christ emptying himself. So it's an attempt to explain how that emptying might have worked. And they go as far as saying that when Christ emptied himself, he emptied himself to some degree, some less, some say more, of his divinity. Yeah, I know. But when I say it that way, when you read it that way, you kind of go, oh, how could that? They can't say that.
Well, you got that song, emptied himself of all but love, and yeah, led for Adam's helpless kind.
But they really focus on the emptying, because the Greek word behind that is like kenosai or something. I can't remember. The Greek people.
Kenosibus, yeah.
The Greek people will correct me on Slack. And if you want to see them shred me, join our Slack.
That's a great, compelling reason.
Yeah, great, compelling.
And you don't even have to join as soon as you hear this. Like, you can join whenever and go back up in the history. I'll make sure to archive the crucifixion of Jim.
So back to theology class. So I learn about this concept, and secretly, with no one watching, I quietly found it compelling. Now, some kenotic theologians go farther than others. Like, some have what might be called like a mild kenosis theology, where they say
the lightest form of kenosis.
And some go pretty far.
Right.
But they try and make sense of some of the passages where it appears that Jesus is not omniscient, where it appears he is not omni-something. And they go, huh, how do I make sense of this? They go in a kenotic direction. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite theologians at the time, the Wayne Grudem before Wayne Grudem was Wayne Grudem, was Millard Erickson. He mm-hmm. wrote a systematic theology called Christian Theology, which was pretty popular. And then Grudem became huge, and then no one really read his systematic theology anymore. Well, I kept it. And he is he's mildly kenotic.
Hmm.
He tries to make sense of that passage by saying that some divinity was given up. So when
sorry, my head just exploded.
but you can see, this is, I'm not a teacher. I'm not an authority on this. I might have even said some things wrong, but this is Jim's faulty understanding of
sure.
of how this works. But there are some evangelical theologians that adopt some of this kenotic stuff. Right. And they might try and get around the hypostatic union in creative ways. I'm not saying those arguments aren't compelling or they're not good, but they do try it. I think they're aware of what's going on. I think they're aware that they might be doing damage to the hypostatic union. Mm-hmm. And I think I secretly like found them, some of them compelling. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of kept it in. And then as the years go by, I was kind of confronted with the fact that, well, you can't be kenotic and adopt a reformed understanding of the hypostatic union. Mm-hmm. So I had to figure this out because I'm like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a kenotic theologian, but dang it, it's making too much sense to me. Why is it making so much darn sense? There's got to be a problem. There's a problem here. So I have to find a way to the reformed understanding. I think the biblical true understanding of the hypostatic union and somehow figure out this kenotic thing. Because it was just, I mean, isn't it just funny how sometimes things can be really weirdly compelling and you know they're wrong at the same time and you just like wonder, why isn't there like a red flag going off in my head? Why is this so easy for me to get?
Yeah.
Like I should be producing all sorts of arguments against it, but like it just wasn't happening for me. I'm thinking I got to get this figured out. So in sum, kenotic theology kind of crept in and made a tiny bit of sense to me. And I noticed it and I needed to find a way to get rid of it. So I kind of went into this book to try and figure it out.
Hmm. Would you say, I have a theory here and you're probably just going to disprove it and be disappointing, but that's fine. Would you say,
wait a minute.
You're always accusing yourself of being disappointing when you answer my questions. So I'm just getting out ahead of it.
Okay.
And telling you in advance, you're going to disappoint me.
Why do I feel so bad now? Like when I say it, it's okay. But when you say it to me, I'm like, oh, okay, David, I'm sorry. I disappoint you.
It's okay. I have gym friends.
Okay. Okay.
So would you say that your reasons why you found it compelling were exegetical and your reasons why you finally rejected it were theological?
Exegetical, meaning that the sense I could make from the text hermeneutically.
Right. From just looking at Philippians 2.
Like when I said appeared, like Jesus appears to be not omniscient.
I'm
getting to is like, based on how I'm interpreting this passage, mm-hmm. hermeneutically, I can't explain it in the reformed way.
This is the sense that seems to make the most sense at face value.
Yeah, that's yes.
And then, what do you do with the word kenosis is used? Like, what mm-hmm. do you do with that?
Yeah, like how do I make sense of this theologically? Because hermeneutically, I just don't have the chops or the knowledge to kind of get out of this sticky wicket. Mm-hmm. I want to say that hermeneutically, I don't think that you're stuck with the kenotic theory. I mean, I don't think you're stuck with kenotic theology. There's just hermeneutically, there are tools available to you that can help explain it. Because, I mean, the Bible is not written like a handbook. It's not a systematic theology. It has to be systematized. Mm-hmm. And so, yes.
Because this is a recurring pattern that I've noticed for me. A lot of the, I can't think of any doctrines that I do this with now, but a lot of the places where I used to say, I don't believe the Reformed position on this. I believe the biblical position on this.
Whoa.
I would say,
recently or like in the past?
In the past. I mean,
okay, I got you.
As recently as like 3 years ago, but yeah, in the past. What I would say is essentially, I couldn't have put it into these words, but somebody articulated it for me recently. Basically that I found a dichotomy between what is believed exegetically and what is believed theologically. Like, yeah, if I have your theological presuppositions when I come to this text, I might come to that conclusion. But if I'm just reading this text by itself, I'm never going to, if I'm just reading the text where Jesus appears to be ignorant by myself, I'm never going to come to the conclusion that Jesus maintained his full divinity. Like if I'm just reading just this text.
Oh, in isolation from the others.
In isolation from the others. What I've seen is when I come to the Reformed position, it's not because somebody came to me and said, no, look at the way that this Greek verb is used. It actually means the opposite of what it appears to mean.
It was a theological.
It's because somebody said that cannot mean that because Paul says the opposite over here. And he says it very clearly. And there's another way to interpret this that while you may, if you never had Paul, you might not interpret it this way ever, but because we have Paul over here saying this clear thing, you need to interpret it in another way so that you don't have the Bible contradicting itself.
Right. Yeah.
I was wondering if that's kind of how it worked for you, where you came to the conclusion that no, Jesus did not lose his divinity because I believe all of these things from all of these other passages.
Yeah.
So I have to be willing when I come to these texts that are confusing to say, maybe they don't mean what they mean at face value because that contradicts what other passages very clearly mean.
Yeah. As you were explaining this, I thought of, how have I done this with other theologies? Mm-hmm. And I think that when I first became a Christian and I'm not, I think it's time for me to be bad cop.
I'm so excited. I have a pirate patch for you.
Thank you. And if any of our Arminian listeners, I love you. I want you to keep listening. I want to be friends with you. You are welcome here. This is a safe space.
You are welcome in this place.
So I was thinking, I think that's how I was an Arminian at first. Because there were these isolated texts that seemed to make sense with the Arminian sense of soteriology. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the biblical acumen at the time to say, well, no, that makes this other passage not true. Mm-hmm. At the time, I just looked at all these isolated things. And I think that's how I expressed Arminianism.
Like the whosoever passages.
Yes. Or the all. Mm-hmm. The all doesn't quite mean all. But at the time, I just thought, well, that says all. It says the world.
Right.
And over time, I learned that you kind of have to make the whole Bible work, not just these individual parts. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that the Arminians don't have a good response to that, but and I love you again, but I think Arminianism has that issue a little bit too.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the small parts instead of systematizing the whole.
Yeah. And there are various reasons why we're inclined to do this. Part of it is just a commitment to wanting to be biblical. Like at its best, what we're doing is we're prioritizing the passage we read first
or read last.
Yeah. Read most recently.
And,
or the one that just seems most dramatic, maybe seems most potent.
And who wants to say that those aren't true or in your mind, go against it? Like you don't want to hear that. You don't want to give audience to those arguments. And I understand that. So
we've gotten basically what you had wrong. You had some sort of kenosis theology kind of bleeding in, maybe in a flirting. Client way. Yeah.
Flirting
with kenosis.
The lightest form of flirting with the latter form of kenosis.
My listeners must hate us. Why are you listening?
Why are you still here?
So what did you end up adopting? You talked about the Reformed position. Do you want to summarize what was the change?
Yeah. So it wasn't like I just had all these errant beliefs about the hypostatic union and I was denying it. That wasn't the case.
Right.
I affirmed it, but I just felt so inadequate. Mm-hmm. I couldn't grasp enough of it. And I was feeling this gap of understanding that I was not comfortable with. I want to get this. How does this work? If you're saying that Christ was omniscient, why does this text tell me what it says? Why do I get the feeling that he wasn't omniscient here? I mean, how is he fully human and fully divine? I mean, that's really the question. How does it work? I want to know the physics of it, the theological physics.
The metaphysics,
Sorry.
I apologize. I was just trying to use the word.
I'm just joking with you. So the metaphysics of the hypostatic union. I wanted to figure that out because I was having problems with the Reformed view of it. So in reading this book, I remember, and it's funny. I was I think I gave this book away. I was looking for it. I'm like, where is my Wellum book on the doctrine of, where is it? And I think I gave it away to someone. So I don't have it, but the light kind of went off when I read his explanation of a doctrine called the extra Calvinisticum. Mm-hmm. Extra Calvinisticum. I've never heard of this. I'm like, mm-hmm.
I had not heard that term.
Mr. Theological Whiz Kid, supposedly Cheese Whiz Kid, had never heard of this highly important, influential Reformed doctrine, kinda.
I have an important question. Can we make an ad about Theological Cheese Whiz? How would that work?
I don't know.
All right.
I'll leave that to you. I'll let it simmer.
Okay. On the back burner.
Simmer down now. So I learned about this concept that I've never heard of before. One, wondering why I never heard of it before, but two, like freaking out over what it meant. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know how baby Jesus could uphold the universe in a divine way. How could that happen? How is that possible? And, this doctrine called the extra Calvinisticum, explained it in a way that was so refreshing and revealing to me. It ended the problem immediately. And because I am not a theological whiz kid, I'm going to read a short paragraph.
That's probably a good idea. Cause I'm sitting here thinking, how would I summarize this?
It's kind of a sticky wicket. I mentioned
It's metaphysics. Metaphysics are always hard.
This is a little weird. So I'm going to read from an article that we're going to post in our show notes. It's an article by Kevin DeYoung. Sorry, David. Written on the.
I like. He is one of the celebrity pastors I'm not actively rooting against.
Yeah, you said that. And I love Kevin DeYoung too. But he wrote this on the Gospel Coalition. I'm sorry.
I even call him Kev sometimes.
You're just bros over there. The lightest form of brodom. So he wrote an article, a brief primer on the extra Calvinisticum that we're going to link to. So I encourage you all to read it. It's going to do a much better job of describing this doctrine than me, but I'm going to try. So from the article, I'm going to quote, the extra Calvinisticum teaches that in the Son's incarnation, the divine Logos is fully united to, but never fully contained within the human nature. In other words, the Son, even in his incarnate state, is able to live a divine life outside extra his human nature. The extra also reminds us that in the incarnation, the Son did not cease to be what he had always been. He continued to sustain the universe and to exercise his divine attributes together with the Father and the Spirit. He didn't give up his position in the Trinity. Mm-hmm. In other words,
it's not like there was a vacancy.
Yeah, like for a short period of time. He didn't empty his divine attributes for a short period of time. When Mary conceived a child by the power of the Holy Spirit, the divine nature did not undergo any essential change. Now,
any change,
any change whatsoever.
Yeah. Because God does not change, because the Bible says that very clearly.
And all of a sudden I realized if his divine nature loses an attribute here or there, the mild kenosis, like a little bit, that he loses the majority. He doesn't lose all of his, he doesn't lose his omnis, but keeps these little things, or loses these little things and keeps his omnis. It's not, he can't lose anything.
Right. And I just need to interject here because this bugs me every time you say it. And I know, you know, it's wrong, but I just need to say that you can't split up the divine nature. God is simple. There is one essence that is God. You can't remove his sovereignty and still have God. No. When you said things again, I know this is wrong, but you were saying this about kenosis.
I thought I was like, what did I do?
Like,
what did I say?
Oh, he only lost part of the divine nature. That's like saying there really isn't any analogy here.
If someone's forced to admit their kenosis, they might say something like that.
Right. And God is indivisible. You can't divide him into parts. You can't remove the sovereignty and still have God. God is, we study attributes because they help us understand the essence that is God.
Yeah.
But ultimately God isn't a collection of attributes. He is God. He is a singular, simple essence. And so any concept of removing part of the divine essence, like it's either God or it's not. It's like papist or not. It's one or the other. It can't be both or part one and part the other.
We got to play that game again soon.
Anyway, you were saying kenosis.
Yes. Thank you for that. And so here's here's what didn't happen when I read that. When I'm just having this miraculous divine moment where I just felt like I was being brought to the very throne of God when I read this, because it just fixed something in me. Here's what it didn't do. It didn't like explain the metaphysics of the hypostatic union.
Right. It's not like you could write a book about like what attributes, how things were transferred, what that, you know. Yeah.
It's an ant trying to comprehend the volcano.
But you did get that eventually it will spew fire on you. Like you did get something about it. Yeah.
And I was thinking that I could comprehend the volcano while being an ant, but all of a sudden, when I read this, I realized I think the whole point behind kenotic theology is a person admitting that they're finite, trying to explain something infinite, and either on purpose or by accident, making the infinite less infinite, which when I say that out loud, it's ridiculous.
Well, technically, it's possible. Well, mathematically speaking, like the set of all whole numbers is larger than the set of all.
Let me rephrase it. Trying to make something that's inherently infinite less infinite.
Right.
You can't change that. You can try and you can claim that you did, but you can't. And all of a sudden I kind of realized, oh, that's what my problem was. I was just a finite person thinking that it was not okay to be a finite person trying to comprehend something that was infinite. And God has given me through his word, an understanding that goes to a certain point. And it's okay that I don't allow you to go any further because you're an ant, you stupid little reformed moron. That's what God told me. And I just said, I gotcha. I submit. I get this. I think that I am absolutely wonderfully at peace with the hypostatic union finally because of the assistance rendered to me by the extra Calvinisticum. And it kind of changed everything. And that's the rest of the story, kind of how everything changed. And some things did change. And that's when I think about it, I'm like, wow, that kind of did change everything. That had to have been an EFS moment for me. Because I realized how stupid I was. That also coincided with my final acceptance that I should never be a pastor because these are waters that I can't just tread in. I mean, I'm drowning.
You're and drowning if, in the kiddie pool.
I'm going to, yeah. I'm,
that's how I felt.
I'm going to drown. It's going to happen. And I should stop being so arrogant, you know? But anyways, I'm getting ahead of myself. You are the interviewer.
This I am the interviewer.
This is your show.
The interviewee.
Yes.
And
so simmer down, Jim.
So my first question in regards to, I'm going to start with before all of this and then we can talk about the change. But do you think that most people grasp the extra Calvinisticum or have a better understanding of the hypostatic union than you did prior to this point?
I don't know, because on one hand, I don't know how many people, even in our circles, know what the extra Calvinistic.
I mean, I didn't know the phrase, but I did believe the theology underneath.
Could they believe the theological concept by accident or on purpose? Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there are some people that have absolutely no issue with the Reformed understanding of the hypostatic union and just don't get my dilemma. But I know there's more than, I know there are more people like me. I know there are people that were like me that just had trouble. They got tripped up with some passages that seemed to indicate something and it didn't jive with what others were saying they should believe about it.
Right.
Cause I think Reformed people, even small R Reformed people want to try on some things, not everything, come to a Reformed understanding about it and defend it because they think it's biblical. And, I think some fail at it. And I have a feeling, I don't think this is as big as EFS. Because I think you and I saw that there were a whole lot of people that were accepting this doctrine and we had no idea why. I do think that there are some like me who were in the same situation that maybe they didn't know what the phrase was, extra Calvinisticum, but they also probably couldn't figure it out if it was presented to them.
Yeah. I think, and partly because of music, I think part one of the default position of the church, there are a lot of like Christmas carols and even like highly regarded Christmas carols.
You seem to have that ability and I don't.
That teach that Jesus emptied himself, like emptied him, you know, emptied himself of all but love in that Wesley hymn.
No, I don't know.
But it turns up, I think it turns up in a handful of places, and people tend to believe more so than theology books. They tend to believe the songs they sing.
Yeah. Well, they just look at that phrase, empty himself, and they just kind of go no further.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably part of it.
They don't bounce it off of other things. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to say that, and I'm just going to kind of shout out to my SBC brothers and sisters here, to your chagrin.
Go ahead, Jim.
Shout. So, during this, I don't know if Wellam cited this, but Thomas Schreiner, SBC theologian scholar, wrote, I think this is one of his commentaries on Philippians, that a good way to understand that phrase, empty himself, was it was emptying by addition. It was subtraction via addition. Mm-hmm. Why are you laughing?
I hate that. Nothing that was phrase. I mean, why? Not in this why? Context. In this context, it does make sense. But it's just funny to me.
Why not?
Well,
why not?
It's mathematically, it doesn't.
Oh, okay. Now I know why this is. It's because you're a nerd, Nick.
Or just a nerd if you're looking to say verbiage.
You see, this is a math thing. So I'm just going to disregard that and move past it.
You should disregard most of the thing. I'm just asking questions here.
just
the interviewer.
Hey, just relax, Jim. But no, the subtraction via addition thing kind of helped me understand that, you know, oh, that's how it worked.
Right.
He didn't empty himself of anything. He couldn't have, but he added something to himself,
which was humbling.
Yeah.
Like his taking on the, it's exactly like we might say when somebody, when a king stoops to the low level of helping a peasant with
something,
he's still a king. He still has all his majesty. If anything, he's added honor to himself, but he has emptied himself by serving on this level or whatever.
So I wanted to mention that. Thank you, Thomas Schreiner. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, that's what, that's actually the phrase one of my professors in Bible college used was, he added to his divinity humanity.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. So yeah.
I think, I don't know how common kenosis theology is, but I suspect that it's more common. And that was kind of the question I was looking at teasing out. Do you think that a lot of Calvinists think they are whiz kids?
Yes.
Why?
Because they're 22-year-old reformed morons.
That's a description, not an answer.
I know. I love to
say that.
I love to say that because I think there's a lot of truth to it. I don't know what it is precisely. Mm-hmm. Like, do I want to say it's inherent to Calvinism? No, but there are a lot of arrogant Calvinists, so I have to figure that out. I think it might have something to do with the cage stage thing. Like when you come into this new world of awesome theology and you just feel so dang powerful. I think that that's where the arrogance comes. The arrogance comes from our sin nature, not Calvinism. but there's just something about, nevertheless, coming into believing this stuff, you feel like a sense of, I'm different than everybody else. Cause you usually are.
You're seeing things in the Bible that nobody else is seeing. Like,
yeah.
Like once you become a Calvinist, like, everybody says,
I've never been taught this. My church never mentioned this to me.
Exactly.
Why am I discovering this just now? And that mixed with hypostatic union with the sin nature tends to go wrong. So yeah, I'm not trying to like defend Calvinism here, but nevertheless, the stereotype is that Calvinists are arrogant. Well, yeah, let's figure that out though. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's inherent to the theology. I think it's just a mixture of sin nature versus this new revelation they find themselves in.
Yeah.
And it applies to a certain kind of Christian. Like, my kids are going to grow up being Calvinists. So it's not going to be like this huge revelation someday. Well, if you grow up Arminian and then switch over to this stuff, you know, it can go wrong. I think me going to Bible college kind of screwed me up a little bit. Because I became a Calvinist in Bible college and then found myself surrounded by all these really thick commentaries and scholarly works. And I was reading all of them and thinking, oh, okay, yeah, I can do all this. I can hang with the big boys.
Right.
And I somehow kind of fooled myself into thinking that I was one of the big boys simply because I could read something or because I had possession of it. So, you know, I'd build my library and think that my theological acumen is strong because I have a bunch of books.
Right.
They're just ornaments. They're ornamental.
Reading the Institutes of Eleintic Theology and reading Turretin on the Trinity did not put me ahead of the EFS game.
No, it like didn't.
It just had no effect.
It just means that you read Francis Turretin on the Trinity.
It did help me with the hypostatic union, though. I should point that out.
Okay, yeah. Not that like you shouldn't read theological books or Reformed ones and try and get what they're trying to say. But what I'm saying is I just kind of lied to myself and felt over time, convinced myself that, well, I somehow bought all these books, so I must be adept. I must be able to, because I have them, right?
Well, and you're reading
and
them.
What a stupid thing for me to say, because that doesn't mean anything. It just means I bought a bunch of books.
Well, and even if you're reading them, like, this is the thing I keep coming back to, is like, I was reading Turretin thinking I was understanding. Like, it's not like I was reading it thinking, what the heck did he just say? Yeah. I felt like I was understanding most of it. Like, yeah. I was hanging out with the big boys, listening to their conversation, thinking that I was understanding the words that they were saying. And like, all the while, I was just an infant listening to adults speak and assuming that they're talking about when they're going to have milk next.
You know what I did with my Turretin volumes? Did I ever tell you what I did with mine?
No, don't tell me you did something horrible.
I did. I sold them. What business do I have reading Francis Turretin?
Well, I'm not going to read. I don't read through Turretin anymore, but I keep it on hand as a reference.
Like on a Saturday night with a log on the fire, you just kind of calmly read through Turretin.
I did do that. Now I don't. when stuff like what we're talking about comes up, the hypostatic union, yeah. And I go, I didn't understand this. That's when I find Turretin helpful. And then okay. I read Hodge and I read Calvin and I read,
fair enough. You know.
Okay. I have one more question about what you think of like the state of other people. Compared to most of church history, what do you think, I guess this is one and a half more questions, but what do you think of the average evangelical Christian's theological knowledge? Like if you were to pick an arbitrary time in church history,
yeah.
Do you think he would know less or more of like basic Christian theology?
Oh boy. Here's where the problem lies with me, because I realize that there are a lot of people like me who have little to no historical understanding of the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
I know that one of my weaknesses is a historical sense.
Like church history and historical theology.
It is my weak point. It's my kryptonite. I just don't know enough. And I have not spent a lot of time because I didn't think it was, because I was dumb. You know, I didn't think I needed to put it on my priority list. And I think, I'm not big on making too many claims on this show, but I think there are a lot of people like me who have a deficient understanding of how theology has found its way through history and the importance of the fact that this little theological concept that I just now figured out in 2015 was actually figured out a really long time ago, definitively.
Uh-huh.
I had no concept of that. And it didn't matter anything. It didn't matter to me as much as it matters now. And I'm understanding more.
That's why I asked the question, because this is my EFS moment. Like what you're saying right here is what David was saying at the same time.
That's my EFS moment, because I realized, wow, I don't know what I'm doing.
What? Same question.
And I think things went wrong. When did they go wrong? I think they started to go wrong in the 1800s. But I can't... Would you stop?
Is that why you only read books from 500 years ago now?
No. What I have to say at the same time is that is coming from someone who doesn't have a really good historical understanding of things. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking you probably think that things were at their peak in the 1600s, maybe started to lose their luster in the 1700s. But, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure Jonathan Edwards took good care of his people, you know, and when it comes to these things. And there were a lot of others like him. And a lot of weird stuff happened in the 1800s, you know, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness stuff, the Scofield Bible, you know, a lot of weird stuff happened. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someday I'll read a Christian history book and figure it out. But
I blame the
Charles Finney, you know,
Great Awakening. I actually do.
I know you do.
Don't worry about that.
So that's what I'm thinking. And I think Charles Finney has a lot to do with this.
Yeah.
I think he has caused a lot of harm that, I mean, we're still doing Finney stuff right now, and it has infiltrated the evangelical church in a big way. So
my answer to this might actually surprise you.
Okay.
Cause same question. If I were to answer it, I think I would say probably about the same.
Okay.
Like in terms of what understanding does your average congregant have, if you pick a random person from now and you pick a random person from the 1800s, a random person from the, I think it's probably about average. Maybe yeah. it's a little bit low, but what I do think is that their impression of their own theological understanding
yeah.
is a lot higher. That if you were to pick a person out of the 500 mm-hmm. AD, they would probably have roughly the same ability to articulate the doctrine of the Trinity, or let's say yeah. anything post Nicaea.
Nice.
But they would think, I've got this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this we can read and we have iPhones yeah. and I read Grudem. Like, and I think that problem only gets worse with Calvinists, which is my other question is like, yeah. do you think that if you picked a Calvinist, do you think they have a better chance at having a better theological education than your average evangelical on these basic things?
Do I want to say yes? Maybe yes, but their opportunity for crashing and burning and just
that's exactly what I would say
is no better. I mean,
it might be worse.
Maybe it's, yeah, you're right. I think it is worse because we think we're just in this land of privilege, this information age. We have everything we have the world's knowledge at our fingertips mm-hmm. in this little electronic box.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of us do.
Some of us, yeah, sure. And I think that tricks us mm-hmm. into thinking that we got it better than people from ages before, but maybe it is worse.
And I'm not just diving into new Calvinists here. Like when I fell into the EFS thing,
I got you.
I was not a new Calvinist. I would have called myself confessional at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we have so much more capacity to screw things up because of the modern age we find ourselves in. Mm-hmm. I think it's tricking us into thinking that we got it or we don't have to worry about it mm-hmm. because the right answers are somewhere in close proximity to me. And, you know, I don't have to work that hard to find them anyway. So I won't choose to hash this out. But well, the immediacy is ever present though.
It used to be that the right answers were hard to find because it was hard to get to the books because either you couldn't True. Read or they yeah. were just expensive or yeah. they were out of reach. Now it's hard for anybody to find the answers because there's so many bad answers because okay. you have to wade through 17,000 books on the, yeah. on the basics of the Christian faith to find the one that actually teaches what yeah. the Nicene Creed says.
With this grand variety of errors that theoretically should have been dealt with and have been dealt with the Council of Nicaea, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is a weird time we find ourselves in for sure.
Agreeing so much. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were talking about the episode.
No, I'm just talking about now, like, you know, I used to think that I was in a quite comfortable age theology-wise, but I'm not safe at all.
How much did realizing your ignorance bug you? Let's just first answer on a scale from 1 to 10.
8 or 9.
And would you say, I'm drilling in on how it bugged you, I guess, would you say this is something every Christian should know? Like maybe they don't need to know extra Calvinistic homework.
My instinct.
But they need to know the theology under it.
My instinct to get irritated by what others know or don't know is not as acute as it could be. Because, you know, I'm Mr. I don't care.
Right. But you get annoyed really easily.
I do. Don't I? This is a future episode. It hurts
my feeling as every time.
A future episode is going to be David's bafflement at the things I choose to care about and the things I don't care about. And how confused.
It is a very, that heuristic is like a mile long.
We're going to wade through those waters someday. But I know in theory that, well, how can we not be on the same page about this? Hmm. I guess that's what I would say. That's where my bafflement comes. It's like, why is it so easy for the right answer to be there, but we get so distracted by the 19 other things that shouldn't even be here? Hmm. The 19 other kenotic explanations for this verse that should not be accessible or obvious. They should be stamped out by now. Mm-hmm. What happened where this cornucopia of theological ideas just all of a sudden became the reality? Hmm. Why are we in a marketplace of weird theological ideas when the right answer is right there? And I guess people are probably, their heads are just probably, they're probably vomiting blood hearing me say that because, well, I mean, I'm saying what the right thing is. Another person may not agree. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we can get into that, but I'm just wondering, like, you know, is it YouTube? You know, is it the publishing companies that publish whatever comes their way and they don't care? You know, is it the I don't know. I just panicked and stopped talking because
I don't have an answer either. I mean, yeah. I think it is YouTube. I think it is the public. Like, I think it's, I think it's a lot of different things. I think it's the fact that nobody feels compelled when they're writing a book that proposes a new idea to address any other ideas that came before it.
Yeah.
At least not within the last 10 years. Like even commentaries, it's hard to find somebody who contradicts Calvin and says, "Now I know I'm contradicting Calvin here. Here's what Calvin said and here's why he's wrong." And even when they do, I usually go back to Calvin and find Calvin addressed their reason why he was wrong and calls them stupid. Like usually there's like three layers of interaction with the theory that the modern commentary is presenting. And the modern commentary only addresses one of those layers and then moves on and says, "See, we're right."
Oh boy. That was fantastic, David.
So it's stuff like that. I think it's the anti-intellectualism. I think it's a lot of things.
Yeah. This is, I mean, this is just, books could be written about this, this strange time we find ourselves in. We think we're in a time of such privilege, but we're in a land of confusion.
But I guess to rephrase the question, if you were to, I don't know, let's say 15 years from now, you're a little bit more comfortable. You feel a little bit more like you have a grasp on the basics of the Christian faith and you're an elder at a church. Not a pastor, but an elder, and somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, could you do a, I don't know, three classes on the basics of the Trinity and Christology, just like Trinitarian and Christological, 3 or 4 weeks. Could you do that? Would you consider it, it is really important for you to address the issue of the hypostatic union and address it from this reform perspective?"
Well, I would say, let me recommend this guy to teach this class, and I'm going to make sure that he gets his hypostatic union thing right. That's what I would do.
Okay. Okay. That's a good enough answer.
I'm never going to be a teacher, David. It's not going to happen. But yeah,
I mean, the hypothetical world, though, I'm happy that you did answer the question.
Yeah. I mean, can we get the hypostatic union right? Mm-hmm. You know, let's mention the extra Calvinisticum. Let's talk about fully divine, fully human. Let's talk about these things. Let's talk about what this passage, you think it means this, but it actually means this because of the 9 other passages in the Bible that speak to it. You know, just reformed goodness is what I want. I want that reformed teacher, small R reformed, new Calvinist teacher to just spew reformed goodness in this class about doctrine of Christ.
Now you said you're never going to be a teacher. Is that because you don't think you have the skill set as like a, as like just somebody who can explain things? Or is that because of issues like this?
A lot of things. I mean, I'm glad I came out of it. I'm not confused about the hypostatic union anymore. But I mean, that question has a whole lot of factors to it, not just this. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why I'm not going to be a teacher and I'm not going to be a pastor or I'm not going to be an elder. This is one of them, that I am so inept at theological formation. I just don't seem to be gifted at it. I'm not the theological whiz kid I thought I was. And I'm okay with that. I am remarkably okay with that. I'm an ant trying to comprehend a volcano, and I'm glad I'm an ant.
My professor at Moody, in the intro to systematic theology course that I took there, he was kind of a loose cannon. And at one point he said, and this resonated with me tremendously. At one point he said two different things. One thing he said was, Christians should always be teaching. Every Christian should be a teacher. When you, and this is how it works in the mission field. Now he's a big missions guy. All right. He said that, when you learn something, you know, you learn, a doctrine of sin, you know, you learn the basics of the doctrine of sin and how man is sinful and what have you, he should immediately turn around and teach that to somebody else. And that should be how the church functions because everybody is supposed to be in ministry. And so as you're learning, you should also be teaching.
Semper teaching.
Semper learning, semper teaching. Yeah.
Semper learning, semper
teaching. And then he also said that you guys who are here, you know, you guys who have, you know, read parts of a systematic theology and have attended some Bible college, like you're here because you have some acumen for teaching or something like that. And if you are at a church that doesn't need your gifts, and I remember thinking like, holy cow, that's me. Like I'm at a church that doesn't need my teaching. Like I was at GCF at the time, our church. And I'm like, they don't need me to teach. Like they have plenty of teachers. He says, if you're at a church that doesn't need teachers, you should leave that church and find a church that does.
Oh no.
So what are your thoughts on this whole, like everybody should be teaching. Like, no, everybody should teach at least a little bit.
I wonder
now
if,
and then.
I wonder if he really meant that.
A little bit.
Or he was trying to say something else and just...
Well, I wonder if he meant half the things that he said. I hope he didn't.
Maybe that's the answer. But someone, a pastor much, 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 much wiser and godlier and more holy than me, which makes me glad that I'm not a pastor and I'm glad that he is, said to me that on the teaching issue, if you say if you don't want to be a teacher and you're not going to teach and you're not ever going to teach something, keep in mind that by default, you are indirectly influencing by the things you say. If you say something out loud to someone, you are influencing them somehow, in some way. And that, in a way, is a way to teach somebody. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to say is, you can never not teach. You're always teaching somehow. Mm-hmm. But you don't, just hit the mic and I don't know why I did that. So if that's true, then yeah, in a sense, we're doing what that professor said.
One anothering, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, how can I not influence the person sitting next to me when I interact with them? Mm-hmm. You're going to do that.
Or if you have a podcast with hundreds of listeners.
So with that in mind, be careful what you say because you have influence on them. Hmm. That doesn't mean, though, that I'm formally teaching.
Right. Or going out of your way to put yourself in a position of even informally teaching a lot.
Yeah. So maybe that's what he meant. And if that's the case, then sure. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's not what he meant.
Yeah.
Of course it was.
I'm trying to be charitable here. So I'm not going to be a teacher. I'm not going to seek the office that teaches anything. But, I'm going to make sure, if I ever talk about the hypostatic union with someone, to try and be correct. Because I might influence that person.
So I've asked a bunch of direct questions, but I'm going to ask a broad question and let you just kind of riff on it.
There's danger here.
How did this change you? What are the things that have now changed as a result of this? You've mentioned some of them.
But my EFS moment helped me finally stop deluding myself when it came to the pastor thing. Mm-hmm. Resolved to not be a pastor. And was so thankful to God, amongst other things, teaching me things and humbling me and saying, Jim, you don't have to do this because you're not equipped for it. I have not given you this gift or calling. And I was finally like, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I wanted to be more realistic when it came to my theological learning life. Stop thinking that I can read Francis Turretin on a Saturday night with a log on the fire with a goblet of wine. And let's be more realistic. Let's shape my theological library, my library of books, to be more realistic of who I am. Intellectual wise. Mm-hmm. I don't need to have a Francis Turretin book on my shelf. I'm going to have other books. And I don't need 7 books on the Trinity. I just need one good one. Hmm. I don't need to have all these crazy scholarly commentaries on my shelf that I will never use. If I ever do, it's just going to be perpetuating this lie that I'm this theological whiz kid. I don't need this commentary. I need this much simpler commentary that's a collection of sermons. Or if not that, just a simple, straightforward commentary from a person much smarter and godlier than me to help me understand what Philippians means. Hmm. I'll have that commentary. I'm going to take all these other commentaries that I have no business owning and give it to someone who will do it. That's exactly what I did. Mm-hmm. I gave away a ton of commentaries to a pastor because I know he's going to make much better use of those things than with me. Hmm. Got rid of some other books that would probably be better suited in others' hands instead of mine. And not be such a loudmouth when it comes to someone asking me a question about theology. Hmm. I answered in a different way pre my EFS moment. I'm going to answer in a different way now. Hmm. Just more deferring. I want to be more realistic with myself and stop lying to myself that I'm a theological whiz kid and I'm not. So that's going to be reflected in my answers.
This is interesting to me because...
And I know this is extreme. Or maybe this is kind of like, oh, Jim, this is a little much. Did you have to do it that way? Well, I mean, there's some other circumstances involved here. There's some other life stuff that's involved here, but I wanted to live in a new way And it isn't just because Jim figured out this new thing about the hypostatic union, but I mean, you know, it was big, but there are some other things that are involved in too. You know, I just felt like I just wanted to stop being fake and I want to be more real. And the renewing of my mind, I want to be more realistic about it and not try and put on this show, you know, Mr. WizKid that knows it all and always has to open up his stupid, dumb, fat mouth in Bible study, you know? So I want to not do that anymore. I want to be more realistic and listen more, and shut my mouth and be in awe. Finally, be in awe of the Trinity instead of being arrogant about it like I was before, you know? So that's what I want to do. That's one of the things. I'm sure I can think of others, but that's what I had in my mind.
That one's interesting to me because I think we did kind of different things. And what I mean by that is, I mean, I put down Turretin because I realized I read this whole thing on the Trinity and it changed nothing. Like it did nothing for me.
Well, I mean, to be fair, when most people read Turretin, nothing changes. Maybe they feel dumber.
But it actually caused me to buy more books.
Really?
It made me realize, I guess it's essentially the thing that pushed me back 400 years of my reading.
Oh, that's what did it.
And that's a difference in like
who
you and I are, because you went, I need simpler books. Yeah. I went, I need to find books that give me the best overview of all the positions from a position that I know to be sound.
Is that why you asked me the question? I don't think you asked it directly, but like, you know, what time frame did it go wrong?
Yeah, that was part of it.
Because you have said in a previous show that the 17th century for you was an ideal century for a lot of different reasons. But I think...
You asked this question of yourself. Oh. I didn't ask the question. I was like trying to remember, when did I ask that? I wouldn't have asked that.
I don't have the mental capacity to do that. You do. But is that kind of related to this? So like you kind of... It wasn't that you wanted to find different kinds of books, but maybe like from certain eras meant more to you. Like you didn't want to bother yourself with books from the 1800s because, or the 1900s,
yeah,
or the 2000s, but books from this certain era,
not just this certain
are doing
era,
what I need them to do,
but a certain theological
presupposition or
train, or, I mean, what I was looking for was books from people who affirm the Westminster Standards.
That's what this is about. You wanted to be more Presbyterian.
And it wasn't even like when I started on it, this isn't about me, but when I started on it, it wasn't like, oh, I need to be more confessional. It was, this is a place to stand while I figure things out.
Yeah.
I don't feel like anything prior to the confessional era, like there really haven't been confessions drafted since, I don't know, like 1689.
the last big one.
Yeah. There haven't been many since then.
That was a good confession, wasn't it?
And just moving right along.
Okay.
And I wanted to go back to that time when people were clear about what they believed why they believed it and articulated the voices of the past too.
When confessionalism was a good thing.
When confessionalism was a good thing and everybody felt compelled to not only defend their arguments against somebody who wrote something 10 years ago, but against Augustine and against, you know, the church fathers, the medievals, et cetera.
Okay, that's interesting.
I'm wondering, that'd be interesting to dig into in a future episode, maybe. Like, why did we go those two different ways?
Yeah, I'm okay with modern books, aren't I? That doesn't mean I'm not okay with books written from eras that you prefer.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't have that instinct that you had.
Yeah, I mean...
I think you intellectually do things different than me. And that's the case.
I had an ad fontes moment and you had an ad simpler moment, I guess, I don't mean that in an insulting way.
I know. I got you. But that's just another example of how I have no clue what you do and you have no clue what I do, but we're friends. So that's why, hence this podcast, folks, you just heard an exchange that perfectly illustrates why this show is a thing. You and I have no clue why the other does what he does. Nevertheless, we're here.
And we're trying to figure it out.
And we're trying to figure it out.
One more question for you. Is this changing anything about how you teach your children? Because you're still called to teach them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that you didn't know that, but.
Well, I mean, no. I mean, the desire and instinct and drive to teach them hasn't really changed. Mm-hmm. But I want to instill theological values in them that I didn't have for a long time. Hmm. I mean, does that mean I'm going to try and teach the hypostatic union realistically to them? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was trying to do that before. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I guess I don't know how to answer that question.
Is there anything like more caution or more, are you more deferring with your kids too?
I gotcha. I think I would be. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And maybe not position myself as the authority that I might have before, mm-hmm. you know, because I mean, Mr. Theological Whiz Kid, who's also a dad, come children, gather around me and listen to me as I teach you these theological things. You're saying it
wrong. It's me.
And now it's a little different. Mm. So maybe that's how it would be manifested differently. It's not so much about dad anymore. Mm. Hopefully that's the case. And teach them the value of books that say, okay, here are all the positions.
Hmm.
More like you.
And here's why mine is right. And here's why they are wrong.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know about that, but yeah, something like that, you know? So, hopefully, I don't know what the answer is right now. It's something for me to think about, but hopefully I do it in a more humble way and teach them to be humble too, when it comes to theological things. Yes, let's get the hypostatic union right. But I want to try and facilitate awe before God theologically. Hmm. I don't know how I'm going to do that, but I have it now. Hmm. I didn't have it before, and I want my kids to have it, because I think that is better for sanctification than, you know, just the narrow, you know, let's get it right. Well, yeah, let's get it right. But there's more here. You know, it should lead to something else. I'm going to try and do that now versus before. I don't think I was very much concerned with that.
So I know I said one more question, but now I have one more.
Yes.
When I asked about my professor and what he said, his argument was basically like, look at all of these people who are suffering and look at all of these teachers who are worse than you.
Okay.
And like the simple fact of the matter is, and people have actually said this to me about our show when we talked about not wanting to be pastors.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, like, there are a lot of really ignorant people out there. Some of them are teaching. Some of them need to be taught.
Yeah.
And you know more than a lot of them. Like a lot of them, like, you know, you and I probably, I mean, realistically, in terms of people still breathing today who are not teaching a seminary, probably in the top 70th percentile, maybe 60th anyway. And that's, you know, that's 60% of evangelicalism that the argument goes.
Why are you saying this?
The argument goes, that's 60% of people who would really benefit from you teaching them something that they didn't know before. Or they end up listening to you instead of some heretic. Like mm-hmm. you're better than Joel Osteen. You have to be better than Joel Osteen, right?
He has better teeth.
You win. So
it's the only time David has done that.
I guess that my question is, like, does that bug you? Does it bug you to say, I'm going to be humble, I'm going to be silent, even though I do know, like, it's true that people listening to me, it's better than them listening to some other people.
No, it doesn't bother me at all. And you know why?
Why?
Because I'm just going to send them the link to Kevin DeYoung's talk that he did on Doctrine of God.
Mm-hmm.
What was it called? The Divine Simplicity, or the Simplicity?
Oh, is this the one where he kind of came out against the FS? I haven't watched this yet. It's
you
on
haven't?
My. No,
you,
I'm so you, upset with me.
How have you not watched
I'm
it?
That so is so upset with coolest. Me. It's because it's on Vimeo, not YouTube, and I can't add it's it to watch
YouTube.
Later.
No, it's on YouTube.
Oh, well, I'll add it to watch later and it'll get done.
It was on, what was the conference that it was last year? It wasn't last year. I think it was the year before that, but...
I don't know.
Folks, we're going to link to this. Just ignore us for
the next. Yeah, and David's going to watch it.
Yeah, it's so awesome.
Yeah.
I'll give him the link to that. Why do it when Kevin DeYoung can do it a lot better than
that's
you?
That's a good point.
That's what I do. That's what I would do. So no, I'm not bothered by it in the slightest.
Hmm.
I have to commit to this.
That's a good point.
I mean, I'm not going to do the thing that everyone does where they say, oh, I'm changed now.
Mm-hmm.
As a way for false modesty, but really they have all these other desires. No, I have to do this.
But are they really?
If I'm going to say this, I have to live it.
Are they really going to watch that whole, like if you were to teach Sunday
they
school,
should.
If
they
you
should.
Were to teach Sunday school, Jim.
Yeah.
And you were to talk about the EFS issue or the hypostatic union issue, you would get it right now.
Here's maybe, but what I would do is
you get it righter than
I'd say class, hearken unto my words. And I would walk over. I would turn the lights off.
Now you all have to watch.
And press play.
All right.
For the Kevin DeYoung talk on the Doctrine of God, which is the best. Oh man, it's so good.
You win, Jim.
Okay, good.
I'm glad. I was angling for you to say something about God's sovereignty and how he'll take care of it.
Oh,
I thought you would say something like that, but really you're just like, oh no, I'm going to take care of it still, but it's not going to be me.
Yeah, it's not going to be me. God will take care of it.
That is true. Yeah, right, true. And I know you believe that.
Let's do this. We need to inspire our audience to actually call us because we ask them over and over again to call us and none of them do. So let's do this. How, folks,
this is good placing it. I think we should place these at the end of the episode anyway.
Yeah. You wanted to do this and haven't been doing it. Prompting our audience.
Prompting. Keep it, yeah. But I mean, talking about Slack and voicemail at the end of the episodes from now on, let's do it at the end of the episode.
Okay.
Because you're about to listen to the whole episode and you're not going to do it while you're listening.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So if you do it at the end, now they have nothing to do.
Moving forward, we'll do that.
Yeah.
So folks, hey, if you have listened to this, it has inspired you to think about maybe an EFS moment of your own, or perhaps a theological game-changing moment, call us and tell us about it.
Also, we should just mention that EFS stands for Eternal Functional Subordination.
We managed to
go this entire episode. No,
I tried to do it like four times and I was talking at the same time as you. You'll hear it. But
I should have been asking questions.
Regular listeners of the show will probably figure it out.
Yeah.
They already know it. So yeah, folks, call our number 707-99-TULIP or 707-998-8547 and let us know what your EFS moment was, if you had one. A theological epiphany that changed things for you, that before it, you were different, and now after it, you're different.
I like that.
What a great way to end the show my stupidity.
And all right, folks. Cut.
Goodbye. Forgot to print a copy for you. Can you punch me in the face right now, please? Kick, punch, anything. It hurt me.
Is this something you want me to do?
I deserve it. No, please don't.